Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, sitting in for Chris Boyd. On her first night at a strip club, Jessica Burson wasn't told to take off her clothes. Instead, she was given what sounded like simple instructions. Go on stage and dance sexy. And even though she'd trained as a dancer, it turned out she didn't really know how to dance sexy. So she studied and ultimately got gigs at two very different strip clubs in New Haven and Hartford, Connecticut. What she learned goes far beyond hip rolls. After years of research, Burson bears all in her new book, The Naked Result, How Exotic Dance Became Big Business. Jessica Burson, thanks for coming on Think.
Well, thank you so much.
So let's jump right in. How did you end up working at a strip club in Connecticut?
Yeah, it's not something that I ever imagined that I would be doing. I was working on my PhD dissertation. I was living in New Haven, but my doctoral work was at University of Wisconsin in Madison. So I didn't have access to TA ships or any other kind of teaching jobs that you normally get as a grad student. I was teaching Pilates. I was doing all kinds of middle school creative dance gigs. But I just really needed to pay my rent. And there was, you know, this is long ago, so classified ads were still in print back then. but every week I'd look at the classifieds and I'd see these ads for dancers. And I'd think, oh, yeah, I'm a dancer. And then I'd look and it'd say, oh, you know, exotic dancing, which, you know, I didn't intend to do. And then one day I found an ad for exotic dance instruction for classes. And that's how I got started.
Wow. So at the time, who knew what you were going to try out? Were you living with your boyfriend at the time?
Yeah. Yeah. The boyfriend at the time, now husband of 10 years.
Yeah.
I was. He was all for it. He thought I should just, you know, see what it was like.
And I'm sure that it was sort of a scary first encounter just to try something new. What was it like when you first went there?
Yeah, I mean, it was new in all kinds of ways. So, I mean, the movement, as you mentioned in that introduction, the movement style was very new. But the environment was also quite different from what I was used to. It was the lessons were actually held at a strip club in kind of a back room. And it was this very downmarket, seedy, smoky, different kind of place from any place I'd ever danced before.
And what were the first lessons like? What did you have to learn? You'd taken dance, you were a dancer, but this was a different type of dance.
Yeah, I mean, my training was in modern dance, and some of that did actually cross over quite well. But, you know, the first thing, as you said, the first thing that my tutor, whose name is Michelle, asked me to do was dance sexy. And I had I sort of thought I could do that, but she kept saying, you know, I was sort of doing what I thought I should do, and she just kept saying, no, dance sexy. Dance sexy.
Nothing you were doing was pleasing her.
No. And, you know, what I discovered through the process of studying with her, but then also dancing myself, was that there really isn't one way to dance sexy, that, in fact, there's lots of different ideas about what that means. But, you know, contemporary modern dance just isn't one of them.
Or so, probably not ballet either.
Yeah, exactly. Right. You can't get up there and do, you know, do your port-a-bras.
Pirouette. Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, so there was her. And then actually in the, you know, second or third lesson, she brought in a male instructor named Wes, who had danced with Alvin Ailey. And so he and I kind of spoke the same modern dance language, which was great. And he, you know, his whole thing was about having poise, that you had to have class. And he taught me how to walk in these, you know, ridiculous heels and not trip and not look awkward and things like that.
Just how far back in history does striptease, does this style of dance go?
Well, I mean, it really depends on who you ask. And I want to say before I go into it that I'm not an expert in that. But, you know, some people would say it goes back as far as Salome and the Dance of the Seven Veils. But I think there are a couple different roots in the U.S. And one of them is the vaudeville traditions.
Oh, yeah.
And burlesque. And then there's all this kind of weird belly dance stuff that was happening at World's Fairs in the late 19th century. And it was, you know, completely fake belly dancing. It wasn't authentically from the Middle East or anything. But I think those two kind of trends or developments kind of crashed together and produced what we think of as contemporary exotic dance.
But everything took off when? When did this become a popular style of dance? Was it in the
60s? Yeah. So, again, depends on who you ask. But, yeah, there was in the late – so there was go-go dancing in the 60s and topless go-go dancers. And this woman named Carol Doda in San Francisco actually started that. And so, you know, all of a sudden there was this idea that you could take your top off and dance around that way, and that was not that would be acceptable in different kinds of clubs. And then in the 70s is really when this idea of the gentleman's club comes up, and the kind of strip clubs that I first started out at started to be replaced by much more upscale, middle class kind of venues. And that part of that was attracting a more middle-class clientele, too.
Okay, I'm going to get to that in one second, but I have to ask, I don't know if you know anything about this. I read that the history, a little bit about the history of pole dancing, and it said that went way back to the 1920s?
Well, you know, there's so many different stories about where pole dance started. I heard at least a dozen in the process of doing this
what's
research.
What's the best one you heard?
You know, I feel like the best one I heard was that it started in Toronto in the 70s. But I don't – like, what was going on in the 20s that you read about?
Okay, I read, and this is just repeating something I saw, that pole dancing went back to when there were traveling fairs and that there were entertainment shows held in tents, and that women would incorporate the tent pole into their routine. So
that
we'll have to
–
maybe a caller will have an idea on whether that's
I hope so, because I love that. If that's true, that's a great story. Actually,
right.
Even if it isn't true.
Yeah. Okay. Well, tell me a little bit more about the places that you started working. The first one that you went to, you said it was sort of a seedy, smoky club. Describe it. And you call it in the book Backstage Bills.
Backstage Bills,
but that
yeah.
wasn't its actual name.
No, I thought it would probably be best not to use the real names of these places or of most of the people that I talked to either. Yeah, it was in a pretty remote corner of New Haven, in a kind of industrial part of town where there weren't a lot of residences and definitely no restaurants or anything like that. It had – you went in and there was a very narrow hallway that you entered into with a ATM machine, which most strip clubs have because you might need that. You know, just like sort of wood paneling from the, you know, 1977 and a carpet you couldn't even tell what the color was anymore. Kind of those rickety wooden chairs set up around a stage. You know, and back then you could smoke in bars, and so it was just always really smoky. Yeah, dark, obviously.
And when you would go in, what was your routine? Would you go straight backstage? Would you pass customers on your way in? Would you completely change your look?
Yeah, I mean, so that was really the first time I went there was really the only time that I went in the front. Most of the time, dancers have their own back entrance that the other staff use too. You go in. You shouldn't interact with customers before you're in your costume and in your character, because you know nobody looks like that in an everyday kind of way. So no, you really try not to see anybody until you can get all your makeup on and put on everything else you need to do and get out. Yeah.
What was your character? I don't know if either, maybe you don't need to say the stage name, but what was it that you dressed up like to take off?
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, I just used Jessie. I'm not really very good at lying and pretending it. And I'm not, I mean, I was trained as a dancer, but definitely
couldn't
not
as an
actor. Couldn't
you have used like your pet's name and your street?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. My stripper name, according to that meme, is Folly LaSalle.
Oh, that's not bad.
which is not bad. But no, I just figured I would just sort of stick as close to reality as possible. But you know, when I'm saying getting into character, it's more a generic getting into the character of a striptease dancer, getting into the character of someone who is appealing and compassionate and paying attention to customers, and totally sexually, you know, in charge of herself, which, you know, most of us in real life aren't. So, you know, I used all kinds of different characters when I was dancing. I had a kind of a cowgirl thing. I had Dorothy from Wizard of Oz, and things like that. But you know, regardless of costume, I think everybody, and really, I think everybody at the club, whether you're a customer or a dancer, but, you know, I think everybody is performing a character to some degree or other.
Uh-huh. No, I would imagine you went in, you were doing this for getting to get some money, but that
yep.
wasn't your first motivation, so to speak. Were you seen as an outsider? Were you accepted or sort of looked at strangely?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really key that I went in there not as a researcher. And there's pros and cons to that, but one of the pros is that I wasn't looking at my colleagues and looking at my customers in that with that lens. So, yeah, I was accepted. I was older than a lot of the other dancers, but at Backstage Bills, I was by no means the oldest.
How old were you at the time?
I was 31, I think, which is really long in the tooth for exotic dance, actually.
Mostly it's so, people who are 19, 20 or...
Yeah, 19, like, you know, 20, 22. Uh-huh. That's kind of the ideal range, I think. But I also, you know, I also wasn't the most educated person there. I wasn't the most, you know, I wasn't the sole representative of, you know, graduate academia or... you know, or anything else, really. There was a huge, huge range of people, huge range of dancers at that place.
And at the other place that you worked, it was a pretty different scenario. It wasn't quite as greasy or sketchy, it sounds like.
Mm-hmm.
What was this one that you call in the book Diamonds? What was
Diamonds.
That one like?
Yeah, it was much more, I think, aligned with what a lot of clubs are now. So kind of, you know, very clean, plush carpeting, soft, comfy chairs, a lot better lighting, and, you know, people in there wearing, you know, the customers were there wearing sort of business attire. There was just a lot less scruffiness, you know.
You described it in the book. You say that at Diamonds, this regional chain, it was more like girl next door types.
Yes. Yes. So the women there, I mean, there I really was the oldest dancer by quite a bit, I think. But yeah, most of the women there, I mean, so in terms of demographics, you know, at Backstage Bills, huge diversity, you know, white women, African-American women, Latino women, women from Russia, women from Venezuela, you know, all over the place. At Diamonds, it was much more homogenous. So almost all the girls were white. All of them were about 20, 22 years old. And in terms of sort of that character that you were talking about, the character was that girl next door, just much more.
And did you see that in their dance styles play out?
Yeah. Yeah, I really, really did. It was the dance style at Diamonds was this kind of slow, not moving too much, not doing anything aggressive. People didn't go to the floor very much. Some women did pole work, but, you know, it wasn't nearly as adventurous or interesting. And just kind of the same. So you kind of knew what you were supposed to do. You get up on stage and kind of walk around and, you know, touch yourself a little bit. And that was really it. And it was clearly just to show that you were there so someone might ask you for a lap dance.
Hmm. Well, we'll hear a little bit more about the other style as well and about whether either are still in existence. It sounds like there's been quite a change since you worked there. You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman in for Chris Boyd. And this hour, we're talking about The Naked Result, how exotic dance became big business. You can join our conversation with author and dance instructor Jessica Burson by calling 800-933-5372 or by emailing your questions to think@kera.org. You can also send me a tweet. I'm @LSilverwoman. We'll be back in a moment.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. These days, we're awash in satires about the world of stripping.
Here's what I do, baby. I close my eyes and let the music take me like I ain't even there.
We're getting married this weekend to Melissa.
You love Melissa?
Oh, very much.
Then go home to her.
What are you, my father?
Yeah, I'm your father. We'll put some clothes on.
You're hilarious.
Like you better topless.
Where do you see me bottomless?
Those were scenes from Frankie and Alice, Striptease, The Last Boy Scout, and Showgirls, all films that feature, of course, female exotic dancer. This hour, we're talking with Jessica Burson. She teaches courses in dance studies at Yale and is author of the new book, The Naked Result, How Exotic Dance Became Big Business. Jessica, let's talk business. How hard is it to actually make money as a stripper, as an exotic dancer?
I think it depends on where you're working, and of course, a lot of other things too. But, you know, I think it's gotten a bit harder with the proliferation of internet porn and things like that. Like, people don't actually have to go out to see a naked lady anymore. But a lot, you know, especially at the more corporate clubs, a lot of it is about hustling to get a lap dance from customers, because that's how you get paid. So the customer pays usually, you know, $20 or something, and you get to keep either all or most of that. But you're, you know, people, I think a lot of people don't know that you don't get paid a wage or anything like that by the club.
Oh, really?
You actually pay the club. Yeah, the dancer is, and this is a source of a lot of class action lawsuits right now, actually, but the dancer is usually considered an independent contractor. And so you pay the club for the privilege of working there. So it's usually, you know, $80 for a shift, $100 for a shift, something like that.
Wow. So you as a dancer are paying the club a fee, and then you are getting to keep all of, or a percentage, or it just depends of what you make that night.
It really depends. So, I mean, when I was working, we got to keep our tips. So whatever you could get somebody to give you, you could keep. And most, you know, almost all the time, that adds up to way more than the house fee that you pay the club.
More than the $80 or the $100.
More than the $80.
I would hope right? so, yeah.
There was one night where I made $11.
Oh, no.
You know, that's what I took home, yeah, after the payout. Because
all
you also
$1 bills, or is that?
All $1 bills. Oh, yeah, that's, yeah. You know, I think in a lot of clubs nowadays, customers, when you go into the club, you have to buy what they call funny money. You buy club money. So, you know, if you go into Rick's Cabaret, you give a cashier $100 and they give you back $80 of club money.
Like Monopoly dollars or something.
Just like Monopoly money. Right. And then they give that to the dancers. And at the end of the night, the dancer has to cash those in. And the club actually takes a fee from both the customer and the dancer. So they're kind of making it on both ends that way, yeah.
So have there been any attempts among exotic dancers to unionize?
Yeah, I mean, not exactly. Not in this country. In the UK, there is actually a sex workers union that's fairly successful and growing. Here, what's been happening is dancers have gotten together to demand that they get employee status as opposed to independent contractor status. And the argument is, you know, the club is micromanaging every aspect of what you do in your labor. So they're telling you what to wear. They're telling you how often you can work, when you can work, how you're supposed to talk to customers, you know, and on and on. So you're not independent. You know, there's not you're not like a contractor going in and fixing a sink and then leaving. So, yeah, there's actually been a bunch of class action lawsuits against some of these big chains, and most of them have won.
Now, we often see in movies women stripping as a way to make money to put food on the table for their families mm-hmm. or as a way to get through school. In reality, how common is that?
Oh, completely common. Huh. I mean, there's all sorts of different reasons that people are doing it. I mean, I think there are plenty of women where it's the best way for them to put food on the table, as you said, and to pay the rent and to support their families. I think even now you can still make a lot more money stripping than you can being a waitress or doing other kinds of service work. But yeah, there's also plenty of people who are kind of doing it on the side because they like it and they are, you know, they enjoy the little bit of extra cash. I mean, there are lawyers that you can find in strip clubs, bankers, all kinds of people.
In the circles that you work in now at Ivy League schools, mm-hmm. how is the world of striptease seen among dance professors?
Well, you know, with a high degree of skepticism.
Yeah.
I encounter a lot of raised eyebrows and kind of arms crossed over people's chest. I think that part of that is to do with how people see striptease and the sex industry more broadly as degrading to women. And so, you know, most people in the dance world, most people in the dance education world anyway, are women. So it's hard for a lot of the other dance professors that I interact with to believe that it's not all about objectification. It's not all about being made to feel degraded and like a sex object.
And how do you explain that to them then, that there's a variety of experiences, I guess, within different within different places?
I mean, you know, to some degree, I feel like a lot of the book is really just trying to make that argument that there's, you know, there's something about using your body and moving your body in a way that you choose and dancing in a way you like. And ideally, I think if you're doing striptease dance well, in order to dance sexy, as you were saying at the beginning of the program, you know, you have to feel it yourself, right? You have to be in your body, present, and enjoying yourself, enjoying your own body. And that can be tremendously empowering for people. So I think, you know, trying to introduce that concept is, you know, can be helpful.
Well, we certainly hear that from celebrities and self-proclaimed mm-hmm. feminists like Beyonce, for example, who, you know, show off their pole dancing skills in videos. But there's a clash among feminist thinkers on whether or not people like Beyonce are really doing something degrading or doing something empowering.
Yeah. I mean, you know, bell hooks famously called Beyonce a terrorist. A few years ago.
She didn't mince words, okay? Uh-huh.
She doesn't mince words, no. And she, you know, that the argument, she was having an argument with Janet Mock and Marcy Blackman, some other, you know, other women of color feminists, about this exact issue. And, you know, on the one side, there's the Beyonce camp saying you can take control over these sexualized images of women if you insert yourself into that world, into that narrative. You can take control over it and you can own it, and it can be actually a source of strength for you. On the other side is the bell hooks camp saying, you know, absolutely not. You're just buying into the patriarchy. You know, so, you know, Beyonce, you're just reinscribing all of these sexist ideas, and you're claiming, you know, yeah, maybe you think that you're doing it because you want to, but it's false consciousness.
As always, you can join the conversation if you're listening. We're talking with author and dance instructor Jessica Burson. You can call 800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. So what did the women who, Jessica, you worked with say about how they saw their jobs? What did they think?
Primarily, most of them saw it as a job, and that's important to keep in mind. So, I mean, I think from the outside, we can have all these very erudite discussions about what it means and is it feminist, and, you know, but for most of the women doing this work, it's work. And so what they were concerned with was their working conditions, you know, and whether or not they were safe and if they were going to be able to pay the rent and all of that kind of stuff. I really didn't encounter anybody who felt degraded by the work or objectified. And I kind of think if that's how you feel about it, you would leave, you know?
You just wouldn't do it.
Or you just wouldn't do it. Yeah. So, you know, I wouldn't at all say that everybody was always, you know, going around feeling empowered all the time, because that's not true either. But when people were feeling abused or put upon, it was because of the work aspect and because of management and things like that, not because of the fact that they were dancing around naked.
Huh. Now, unlike stripping, which definitely has some murky origins, you write in the book that lap dancing maybe has a little bit clearer of a beginning. How did lap dances become standard, at least, at strip clubs?
Yeah. So there was this guy named Michael J. Peter, who was an entrepreneur and a hotel management guy in Florida. And he bought one of these really seedy independent clubs, kind of like the one I worked at. It was called The Dollhouse. And it was sort of a biker bar that had strippers, you know, very rough. And he decided that the thing to do would be to rebrand, I guess people would say nowadays, and put the dancers in evening gowns. He hired etiquette coaches for them.
Oh, wow.
He, you know, redecorated so everything was really nice and kind of, you know, looked luxurious, put different things on the menu, stopped selling the $1 beers, and was enormously successful with this model. And eventually he developed, it was called tableside dancing back then. There was a rule where you couldn't dance naked unless you were on a stage, or topless, I should say, probably. So he had this idea that if the dancers had these little fold-out tables, that would be legally considered a stage. And so you could call a dancer over and she'd put this little table up and then dance on the table. And, you know, that was sort of as close as they were allowed to get. But then, yeah, he's the one who eventually brought this idea that you could have private dances. And part of that is because then, you know, there's even more money exchanged. But the other part is that the customer feels really special. You know, it's not just going to see a theatrical experience or whatever. It's somebody really paying attention to you, performing just for you.
And you write that that's so important if you're going to try and make money as a dancer. You really need to master the art of making someone feel important in the audience.
Absolutely. That's the only way that they're going to pay you. I mean, I really saw this over and over again, that there wasn't a direct, I certainly thought this going in, that, you know, the prettiest, you know, sexiest, most attractive women were going to be the ones making the most money. And that just wasn't the case. It was really the women who were the best actresses, actually, who could really make the men feel listened to and appreciated and special.
Let's go to the phones now. John in Dallas. Are you there, John?
I'm here. Thank you. Yeah, I just wanted to comment that in the 80s, I knew a young lady who was very talented and gifted with a beautiful body. And she had a goal to raise enough money to buy a horse ranch. And from what I understand, she did. She would take care of business, you know, like it was business, and go home and work out and, you know, keep herself in shape physically and mentally, and attain that goal.
And interesting. A horse ranch. Yeah. This was in Texas, I'm guessing.
Yes.
All right.
So
that seems like a very a highly successful story. It seems to me it would take quite a lot to buy a horse ranch.
Yeah,
you know?
That's a lofty goal, but I guess you go in and you're determined. Now, to make that much money, to whether it's to buy a horse ranch or to get through school or what have you, how often are you pressured into doing something that maybe goes beyond stripping?
Yeah. I mean, I think you know, I feel like every question you ask me, I'm saying it depends, but it depends. certainly at the sort of more downmarket clubs, there's more of an attitude that anything goes, possibly. I don't know how many women feel pressured into doing things, but certainly, you know, they can, or they're asked, you know. At a lot of some of the more upmarket clubs, I feel like that all has to go on off campus, so to speak, because they do want to keep themselves legal and viable. So I think, you know, pressure, I mean, pressure if you feel like you really want to make a lot of money, I suppose. But I saw a lot less of that, actually, than I was expecting, in a way.
Now, there's a chain you describe as the McDonald's of strip joints, which, of course, is based here in Texas, Rick's Cabaret. Tell me how that place runs.
So, yeah, Rick's is, I grew to kind of love love Rick's, just in terms of the sort of mythology and the stories involved with it. But yeah, it runs like any other major corporate restaurant chain, kind of, and that's really what they're aiming for. It's, you know, they have they're traded on the stock market, and they have a bunch of subsidiary brands, so they're having a lot of success with that. So you know how like the Gap and Urban Outfitters and Banana Republic, they're actually all the same corporation. It's kind of like that. So there's Rick's Cabaret, which is kind of the fancy one. They have Club Ecstasy, which is sort of more for white working class guys. They have Club Onks, which is aimed more towards African-American men. So they have like a bunch of different different groups. And they have this thing now called Bombshells, which is a restaurant chain.
Well, we've got lots of those in Texas.
I am sure. Yeah. I mean, Texas is kind of a hub of all of this stuff.
Yes.
So you know, Rick's is all over the place, and they've got all these different fingers and lots of different pies.
And you say that it's pretty high tech as well to monitor employees.
Yes.
That they're actually, there's checkpoints and fingerprint scans or swipe scans or something.
Yeah.
As well.
Which is all crazy. I mean, coming from the type of club that I did when I started out, where, you know, no one even had to show an ID. There was no expectation that anything was legit at all. But yeah, at Rick's, you get fingerprinted and you're scanned in, and then your name, there's a computerized system that, you know, when you put your fingerprint in, it sends the information up to the DJ so he knows you're there, and it kind of goes from there.
Get your music up in the queue.
Exactly.
All right. You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Lauren Silverman, in today for Chris Boyd. This hour, The Naked Result, How Exotic Dance Became Big Business. As always, you can join the conversation with author and dance instructor Jessica Burson. Call 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. You can also send me a tweet. I'm @LSilverwoman, and we'll get back to the phones in just a minute.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think. I'm Lauren Silverman, in this week for Chris Boyd. We're talking with Jessica Burson. She's a dance teacher and a former stripper whose new book is called The Naked Result, How Exotic Dance Became Big Business. We've gotten a few calls, and I want to go straight to the phones now to Alex. Alex, who's in Dallas. Hi, Alex.
Hi.
Hi there. Go ahead.
So I currently am a dancer in the Dallas area. One thing I'd like to mention that I feel like hasn't been is how dangerous the industry actually is. It is glamorous and it is safe to an extent, but I don't know. Whenever I first got started, there was a lot of glamorizing going on, all sorts of stuff, and no one really talked about how much like drugs and alcohol and all sort of stuff actually go on in the clubs. And my friends, you know, I'm 20, and so I can't legally drink. And there's constantly, oh, well, I'm cool with the manager. I know so-and-so. It's fine. And it's not fine. And they make you, or they don't make you. They try to make you do things that you don't want to do. And I have a lot of friends that are my age that are interested in dancing. And you try not to speak poorly of the industry, and you try to glamorize it because, you know, I mean, it is a rough industry. But I feel like we really need to talk about how dangerous it can be, because it is glamorizing and empowering, but a lot of things happen that you don't want to happen, or you get pressured to do things that you don't want to do.
Thanks so much, Alex.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, I'm just wondering, like, what kinds of things, like, what have you experienced? What have you felt pressured to do? I mean, you're talking about drinking, but I'm just wondering what other experiences you've had or what kind of dangers you see.
There's a lot of pressure to do cocaine in the classier clubs. There really, really is. They always want to go to VIP. They always want to do coke with you. Mm-hmm. And also, pimps will approach you like crazy. You know, they're like, I'm trying to help you make money. I'm trying to help you make money. And you're like, well, help me make money by getting some dances. And they're like, no, I'm talking big picture, big picture. And then you leave and you go and talk to some of the dancers and they're like, oh, you're talking to so-and-so, you know, he's a pimp. And you're just like, what? I had no idea.
Right. Interesting. Thanks so much for your call, Alex. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
So do you think that that's changed over the past, you know, decade or two in terms of being approached by pimps? Has that always been the case?
Well, I feel like some of this is somewhat specific to Dallas and to Texas and to different, I mean, not only, but right, to different places with different levels of activity, right, and sort of standards about how that all works. I feel like on the East Coast, I just didn't hear that story very much about being approached by pimps. I mean, it makes sense. But the part about being asked to do cocaine, yeah, absolutely. I don't think that's changed much at all. In fact, I wonder if it hasn't gotten a little bit better. It seems like, you know, not as many people are doing cocaine now as were in the 80s, for instance. But yeah, I think there are dangers, there are downsides, there are bad people involved. You know, there's all of that stuff is absolutely true. Yeah.
Now, over the last decade, we've definitely seen more male strippers, or at least in movies.
You are the husband that they never had. You are that dreamboat guy that never came along.
Well, you were turning me into a fancy dancer.
Listen, ladies, we are strippers, aren't we?
We sell fantasy, not sex. Sex has an ending. Fantasy never ends.
The full Monty. You lot. That would be worth a look. See you there, then.
Our feature presentation, the one and only. The star of the show, Mr. Magic, Mike.
Jessica Burson, those were clips from some movies featuring exotic male dancers. There at the end, Magic Mike, of course. How do you interpret these movies featuring male dancers?
Yeah, I think, I mean, you know, I would say, you know, good idea, good for them. It's just that the idea of a male stripper is completely different from a female stripper. What they're doing it for, how women receive those performances is completely different. You know, I didn't write about male stripping, but from what I know or what I have read, for the women who go, it's much more of a bonding experience with other women that they're going for.
Interesting, with friends.
You know, you go for a bachelorette party, right, or something like that. And the performance, the men are actually expected to really be able to dance. The performances are usually highly choreographed. They're not doing stuff by themselves very often. It's, you know, very frequently it's a group number that then sort of branches off into solos. There's, you know, humor and costuming and all kinds of stuff. So it's a more theatrical sort of experience, I think, for everybody. I just feel like in the world that we live in, it's a very different, it means something completely different for a man to take his clothes off than for a woman to take her clothes off.
Yeah,
it's easier to make a movie. It's like more fun, right? It's much easier to make a movie about guys doing this because it's like a fun story as opposed to one that has any kind of problematic aspects.
Now, do women dancers talk about male dancers? I know it's such a small percentage, but is that something that's even on the radar?
I can't speak for everybody, but no, I would say probably not. It's just those venues are completely different. Chippendales is completely different from any strip club that has women dancers. There's a whole other sort of separate phenomenon of gay strip clubs for gay men, which are much closer to the kind of clubs that I write about, in that it's a little bit more one-on-one and individualistic and things like that. And again, you have male patrons, so the customer base is kind of similar and the way they're approaching it is similar. But yeah, I don't think most women strippers are thinking about men strippers at all. Yeah.
What's the difference between strip dancing and burlesque?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think it gets people can get very worked up about the differences and if there are differences or not. You know, burlesque has had this real resurgence in the last, let's say, 10, 15 years. And so all kinds of women do burlesque now. And it's seen as something that's, you know, like maybe a little cheeky, you know, but absolutely not sexist. And part of the burlesque and the neo-burlesque movement and resurgence has been distancing themselves from exotic dance and from strippers. So I just over and over again, I encountered burlesque dancers saying things like, oh, well, you know, when I'm taking my clothes off, but it's art. It's not for sex. I'm not like those strippers. So, I mean, there is a real divide. And I think that's a shame. Like, I think actually each group and each style has something to offer the other.
Now, you describe, which we talked about in the segment past, a Texas-based club, Rick's Cabaret, as this mm-hmm. McDonald's of strip joints. But you also talk about a movement in the other direction, a sort of rebuttal of corporate striptease. Describe this movement, and you say it's embodied by something called the Erotic Awards.
Yeah, yeah. I'm about to go investigate this more fully. It's something that happens in London. And actually, I just found out I got a full
break. What a boring event that
go.
Must be.
Yeah. It's kind of the most crazy thing I've ever seen. And I'm, you know, I haven't seen a lot of crazy stuff. But yeah, it's an event that is organized as a fundraiser for a charity called Outsiders in the UK and London, which helps people with disabilities lead fulfilling sexual and romantic lives. And that takes all kinds of different formats. But the basic idea is that people with physical disabilities should also be able to have access to this part of human life. And the Erotic Awards features a mix of able-bodied and disabled dancers and artists, I guess I would say performance artists, doing stuff that, you know, just defies any kind of description or genre. I mean, so some of it is kind of traditional striptease. There's a guy named Matt Fraser who's the MC of this every year. And some people might know him from American Horror Story. I think he was on the season that was at the circus. But he, in the UK, is what was called a thalidomide baby. His mom took a drug that resulted in birth defects, and he doesn't have arms. He's got hands, but no arms. And he does that. He's kind of famous for this stripping act he does, where, you know, he very lasciviously, like, you know, takes off his jacket. And he's got prosthesis. He's got prosthetic arms on. And you know, eventually he kind of strips down, and then he strips off the arms too. And it's just this great kind of whoa moment. Yeah, there's, you know, people. I saw a woman with MS doing a really great dance in her wheelchair. You know, there's just a huge range of things, but all of it is very anti-establishment, absolutely like resisting ideas that, you know, you might have about disability or what's sexy or what kinds of bodies can do erotic dance, all those kinds of things.
Do you see that at all in the more traditional clubs? Any embracing of not just one standard body type? How has that changed over the years?
Yeah, I think, you know, unfortunately, I think it's sort of going the other direction.
Oh, it's becoming more standard.
It's just becoming more and more standard, yeah. I think there are these little pockets that you can find where something different is going on. There are some independent clubs that feature older dancers. There's some that feature heavier dancers. But in general, I feel like, you know, just like in mainstream media and advertising, kind of the way women especially are supposed to look has become pretty standardized. I think the same thing is happening in the industry.
Talk a little bit about clubs, and you worked at two different ones in very different mm-hmm. neighborhoods, and you started to describe a little bit about the dance style differences in neighborhoods that maybe aren't as well off. Is the dance style different? Is the what's expected different than in the classier clubs?
There is actually a huge range when you're start talking about some of the more independent clubs and some of the more kind of down market clubs. Yeah, I think there's a lot more possibility for dancers to decide how they want to dance. There's just a bigger range of what kind of thing might be considered to be sexy or appealing. So, you have dancers doing more stuff on the pole or doing stuff on the floor or doing really kind of sharp, aggressive dancing. I also discovered that in clubs that, you know, are pitched towards a more of an African-American clientele, the expectation of virtuosity is different. So there's an expectation that you really should be able to actually dance.
Not just
at those clubs.
Show your body.
Not just kind of float around and show your body. Exactly. Like, you really need to have some skill in those kind of clubs too.
Now, what did you uncover about the secrets to so-called to dancing sexy? What does that mean?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a straight answer exactly for that, but I really felt like when it came down to it, knowing yourself and dancing as yourself, like, that was what was sexy. That the women who inhabited whatever style they were doing at the time, but like whatever they were doing, they were there. You know, they owned it. And I think that's what people, you know, you mentioned Beyonce before. I think that's what people respond to with her. She really feels like she's present in her body and she believes what she's doing. And that, I think that's sexy. And it has a lot less to do with what you look like or how old you are or, you know, in the case of the group I was talking about in the UK, like, even if, you know, you have arms or legs, like, that's not really the point. The point is, like, are you really you in your body, being true to yourself?
And how does that bleed through into your work today as a dance instructor? Do you take lessons that you learned from learning how to do erotic dance into modern dance at all?
Yeah, I don't, you know, I don't teach actual, I don't teach studio dance very much anymore. I'm more teaching dance history. But I do take that sort of idea that I was just talking about into both when I'm teaching, you know, kids how to do movement. A lot of times, if I am teaching those classes, I'm teaching non-dancers, people who don't have a lot of training. And I think people have so much fear of any kind of dance most of the time. You know, it's something people feel really awkward about. And I feel like, you know, if I can just convince them that if they're really just committed to what they're doing, it's going to be good. You know, that's all you need to do.
Huh. And are there certain ways that you can help someone get into their body to commit to that?
Yeah. I mean, that's something that there's no quick fix for, really. I feel like most of what we do in our lives in this point in time in this part of the world is the opposite, right? We sit in front of screens and we, you know, do little tiny movements of our fingers or something. But, you know, just helping people breathe fully. You know, something as simple as that can really help. Having any kind of body work or, you know, somatic work, yoga, all those kinds of things, I feel like can be really useful.
Fascinating. Jessica Burson teaches courses in dance history at Yale University and is author of the new book, The Naked Result: How Exotic Dance Became Big Business. Jessica, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Knabe, with help on the phones today from Kristen Taylor. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington, and you can contact us via email, think@kera.org. I'm Lauren Silverman, in for Chris Boyd. We'll be back tomorrow.